Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is the Gist of Freedom. This is the host, your host, Leslie Gist. Tonight we have a special show, something that's near and dear to my heart, genealogy. I like to find out if we have our guest on the line, Mr. Bob Scott. Are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Great. I'm so glad we were able to get you through. Could you introduce yourself to our Gist of Freedom audience?
Yes. My name is Robert Scott. I'm the president of the African American Genealogy Group, Philadelphia, and I've been a member, I guess, for about 10 years. And our organization's been, I guess, been around since 1989. And so the purpose of our society is to assist people in the Delmarva area in doing their family research.
Okay.
And
go ahead.
No, I'm sorry.
I was just wondering what happened in your life to get you involved with genealogy.
Well, you know, I guess I've been doing it for about 20 years, but my uncle got me interested in a way because I was in the military, and as I traveled around the country, you know, I would stop at various places, and so one day we had a conversation, and he asked about all the places I had been, and so as I just told him about the different places. You know, he would tell me that I had relatives who lived in certain areas. And so I said, well, why don't you make me a list of the relatives and I'll pay them a visit or either call when I'm in the area. And so, but anyway, he challenged me to do that. And I took the challenge on and it eventually just led me into genealogy because I had to do that in order to try and find out about other family members. And so I just got hooked on genealogy and I've been doing it ever since.
Now, when you would visit these relatives, would you share your information and show them how you guys were connected?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, and it was just amazing because a lot of the relatives, did not know about me as well. And so it was just really just a pleasant experience to meet me and to know that there were other family members out there. So it just became a two-way avenue. You know, it's like... I received benefits, and they did as well because they found out more about other family members.
Well, I know when I did my research, a lot of people were a little iffy and not too receptive talking to strangers. how did you make these people a little bit more comfortable? Did you have pictures? Did you ever get rejected? You know, can you delve into that experience?
Our listeners
need to be aware that genealogy is not all, you know, fun and games.
Oh, it's not. And you know, I've had my moments where, you know, I've visited people and sometimes I would call them, let them know that, you know, I would like to come past and pay them a visit. And there were a few that were not very receptive, but at the same time, because I knew I had names that they were familiar with and that they could relate to, so in a lot of ways, you know, they were very, very open and allowed me to come past and pay them a visit. But there, you know, there were instances where people would not reach up to the ball, but they really were in the minority. And so a lot of times I found that once I explained to them about various other relatives that they were familiar with, then it became much more open in inviting me into their homes and providing me with the information.
Can you give us a story of maybe one of the greatest finds or people that you're still connected to and you know, that you discover something awesome about your family when you met this individual?
Well, you know, I guess there's quite a few of those instances. You know, I had one cousin, and we talked a lot. Now, I had never met her, but I knew about her, and I would call her from time to time. And she mentioned to me that her father was like a double cousin, and so she told me about him being a first cousin to different parts of the family. So as I researched and I couldn't find out any information about the line of the family, and I called her back to ask her for some assistance. And so she told me that one of the relatives I was looking for was a secretary for one of the churches in our home, with the family home, I guess the family home city. And so, you know, to make a long story short, I was able to track her down. And, you know, and the two families that I had that were still living there, you know, I put the word out that I was looking for her. I didn't know her name, but eventually a gentleman called me and wanted to know why I was looking for her. And after I explained what I was doing and why I was looking for her, you know, he gave me her number, and I was able to call, and they eventually made a trip to see her, and she had collected just a lot of family funeral programs, and the programs were just so significant because they just helped me find so many other people. It was just like going into a vault with just loads and loads of information. It was just, you know, that rewarding. And
wow.
So that was
how many years of funeral programs do you think she had?
Oh, she had at least 15, 20 years of them. You know, it was just amazing.
Wow. Now, explain to our audience why is that so significant. You said that there's a lot of names in there.
Well, yes, because a lot of times, you know, depending upon who writes the person's obituary, the deceased obituary, a lot of times they include information about the parents. Of course, they had when they were born, but also about siblings, their children, and sometimes, and if it's a female, for example, you know, if it had a female daughter, then most times they would give the daughter's married name and also where they were living at. So it just helped, you know, it was an aid in helping you, number one, find the name, but then number two, find out where they were living at. And, you know, I could then use the white page, the telephone directories, to go see if I could find if they had a telephone listing in the book. And more often than not, they did. And so then I would just call. And again, I have to explain who I was and why I was looking for them. And 9 times out of 10, they were very receptive and have me come by and talk to me. So just
what do you do with all this information? The information you gather from the program, and once you get all this information, how do you log it? How do you file it? and what is the ultimate project that you
well,
usually do once you finish?
Okay, one of the things I do, I generally take that information and I put it into, you know, there are a number of genealogy software programs out here that you can purchase. For example, there's Family Tree Maker or Legacy or Roots Magic. So there are any number of programs that are available to you. And so, I would take the information and enter it in one of those programs, which then allowed me to print out a chart or a family tree. But my ultimate goal is to do a family history book about the family.
Wonderful.
And,
Now, do you put your tree on display?
No, I haven't. The only thing I've done with it, I've created a family website, and some family members can go to that website and look at the tree and update it, or provide me with the information so I can update it, that it is current with births, weddings, and we also have family reunions. So it's just a way of just staying in contact with the family.
That was my very next question. Do you take these family trees to the family reunion?
Yes, I do. In fact, for the past, we've had maybe 9 family reunions, and so generally, and I'm. At each reunion, I've been able to obtain additional information, so I generally pass out a copy of the tree at each reunion to all the family members.
Now, over the years, how have your family responded to the family tree? Were they disinterested at the beginning, and is there now a trend where more people want to be a part of the family tree?
Oh yes, I think once I started that, I found that, for example, sometimes I ask family members for photographs, or I may be missing information about grandchildren, and so if they're not there when they see the information and their family's not there, they want to make sure that they contribute so that person's name can get into the book, into that tree. So once they see it and they know what I'm doing. They're more than, they just want to make sure that I have all the available information so the tree is current.
Now, I know in my family I have a lot of people, especially my mother, who is very apprehensive about sharing her information. She's afraid of
identity theft.
Right. And we also have a newfound relative on her side of the family who just sent her a book about 200 pages thick of her family tree. And I can't get the lady on, the author of the book, because of more privacy issues. So how do you convince family members that first they shouldn't be too apprehensive about sharing their information and that it's important toward a family legacy? How do you convince them?
Well, in some ways I've been fortunate because that really hasn't happened too frequently. But then at the same time, I think, if for those who are apprehensive, it's really just about, because number one, the information that I have has not been published, and so so when I pass the information out, it's just to within the family. And if it's someone that I'm not really familiar with, then I may give them a copy of a tree, but it will not have birth dates in it, for example. It may only show, though, the deceased family members with dates of birth and dates of death. But for the living family members, there won't be any dates of birth, for example. So that's one way to assure them that, you're not, just being very liberal with passing out that information, because we do have to be careful, because identity theft is a problem.
So on your website, is that a secure site, or
protected? It's password protected. So the only people who can access it will be those people I've given the password to. And I only give it to the people that are family members, or I know of, that I've been questioned to see what their need to look at the tree is. And at the same time, the tree only provides you with a certain amount of information. It will not give you birth dates for the living members, for example.
Right.
Okay, so...
Now, has anyone approached you and was excited about finding a family member as a result of the work that you've done?
Oh, yes. Because, I get, you know, within any family, there are just a number of branches. You know, for example, if you have female family members, for example, you know, they get married. And so, whoever they marry becomes a new name that comes into the family. And so, you know, a lot of times, you know, they want to do their own research for their particular family. And so a lot of times they go off and they do that. And so a lot of them have been motivated to go out and do that.
Wonderful. And let's talk about your organization. And I thank you for sharing, you know, your private stories about your family and your experience. But now let's talk about the organization that you're president of and a little bit more into depth of how that organization operates and how you meet and things of that nature.
Okay. We meet on a monthly basis once a month from September to June. We don't have a meeting in July and August. But at our meetings, we generally have speakers, and the purpose of the speakers is to provide us with information on how to do research, different resources. For example, we can go down to the National Archives, and in the Philadelphia area, you know, that's at 9th and Chestnut. Where you can look at the census records. And so, you know, the census records were done every 10 years beginning in the 1790s. And so you can, you know, in essence, track your ancestors if you know the names, you know, from every 10 years to see where they were living at and who was part of the family at that point in time.
When you say 1790s, that was the first census?
1790 was the first census, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, most African Americans, you know, most of our ancestors were slaves, and so they really weren't in the census until by name until 1870 was the first census after the Civil War.
100 years later.
After the Civil War. That's right. After the Civil War, and when everyone, you know, all the slaves had been freed, and so. That was the first census where every person was on the census by name to include African Americans.
Well, how were we listed prior to 1870?
Well, if your ancestor was a slave, you weren't listed. There were a couple of what they call slave schedules that were a part of the census in 1850 and 1860. But again, the slaves were only identified by sex and age, you know, with that slave owner. So unless you know the slave owner, you know, that's the only other way to try and go back and see if your ancestor might have been on that slave schedule. But again, it's not, you know, there are a few rare instances where they were identified by name, but for the most part, they were just identified by sex and age.
Now, are you familiar with Alex Haley's search?
Oh, yes. In fact, you know, that was one of the, I guess, his book and the TV series, you know, I guess, really motivated a lot of us to think that we could really do that. And a lot of us have. You know, it's been just a tremendous journey to start that and at the same time to be able to go back in time and identify the slave owner. But for a lot of us, you know, that's really as far back as we can go because, you know, as you know, with slavery and the way that the way that it was done, you know, they basically tried to make sure made it hard. Well, not only that, because you know they wanted to, because you know we were considered less than human, so they really wanted to stop us from thinking about Africa, or and passing on the, you know, anything from Africa to the next generation. So it just becomes very, very difficult.
Could you explain to the audience how Alex Haley was able to trace his roots?
Well, he had a lot of, you know, he had a lot of oral history. I mean, there were stories handed down from generation to generation about the first ancestors that came to America. You know, if I remember right, it was Kente. So he had names that he could go back and search until he found the tribe that Kente belonged to. And so, you know, for us, you know, unless we have something similar to that, which most of us do not, you know, it just becomes a very difficult search trying to go back to try and find out where we came from in Africa. And so really the thing that really helps us nowadays is DNA.
Wow, that's powerful. One of the avenues he used to trace his roots was the slave ship. You know, he was able to go to the port and find out which ships were settling in a certain area closest to where his relatives were enslaved.
Right. Yeah. But the key thing was that he had his ancestors' African name, and mm-hmm. see, really, those ship manifests. Where the slaves were shipped from Africa to the Americas, for example, those ship manifests exist. But unless you can identify the name, it becomes almost next to impossible to identify your ancestor. Pardon me?
You mean the name of our ancestors?
Well, for example, the ancestor that was captured in Africa and brought to the Americas, you know, what was his African name? See, most, and that's what escaped most of us, because we don't have a clue to what the name was.
But if you know what ship he was on, it's easy to find at least what part of Africa you're from.
Well, but the problem is there were, you know, for example, there were several ports of entry. You know, for example. There was Charleston was one of the main ports of entry for African slaves, but there were others, you know, New Orleans or Richmond, Savannah, and at the same time, early on, a lot of slaves went to the Caribbean before they came to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's where, you know, all the research comes into play, because you're trying to track. To see where your ancestors, and this is what route they took, and
right.
In some cases that's easy. In some cases that's doable, but it's just a very, very difficult search, because you know you're going through trying to find documents to provide the answers for you, again, part of the problem is we have no one to talk
to.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to this album where he talks about it, and I was just amazed how he was able to track that ship. And the name
right.
of the ship and
mm-hmm.
the route, and it was just an awesome search. Is there anything about your search that is so profound that you share with your little ones in the family? You know, are there stories, because we both mentioned that, you know, Alex Haley got a lot of his information from family stories and like family griots.
Well, we don't. Mm-hmm. No, actually, within my family, we never had stories like that. Most of, you know, a lot of times, we just have not been fortunate to have stories like that. And so, I've gone off on different tangents because, number one, you know, I had one of my earliest ancestor. He had, by the time he died, he had accumulated quite a bit of land. And so, you know, for a lot of us, we wondered how he was able to do that. And so that's been part of our research, to try and go back and try and determine how he was able to purchase so much land, after he was freed as a slave and before he died.
Now, what do you rely on? What your family members told you about him? Or do you find documents? Which one is more valuable to you?
Oh, the finding the documents. I mean, because of, we all have a lot of oral histories that has been passed down. But then, you know, what I've come to find out is that all the oral history is not always correct. You know, there's some truth to it, but again, it may not be the entire truth. And so you want to be able to go back and find documents to support that oral history. And so in some cases, I've been able to do that. In some cases, I have not. You know, for example, one of the things I've been told is that one of my early ancestors were Native American, but I have not been able to prove that as of yet.
Wow. All right. Now, we only have 5 minutes left. Could you tell us about where you guys meet as far as your group and give us your contact information and anything else you want us to know about upcoming events? Or how we met, you can mention that.
Well, yeah, we met at the Black History Expo in Philadelphia on Easter Sunday weekend at the Civic Center, at the Convention Center, and but we meet once a month, second Tuesday of each month, at the Community College of Philadelphia, Philadelphia campus, which is 4725 Chestnut Street. We meet from 7 to 9 on the second Tuesday. Let's see, what else?
Your website?
No, and we do have a website. The website is www.aagg.org. And you can provide, you know, it'll give you information about the organization, where we meet, and the history of the organization. And so, you know, I invite everyone to come out. You know, our meetings are free and open to the public. You know, there's certain things that we do that are for members only, but our general meetings are open to the public. And so feel free to come out and spend a few hours with us, and hopefully we get a chance to motivate you enough to come back and become a member.
And what are the benefits of becoming a member?
You said the benefits?
Are the benefits of becoming a member?
Well, basically, you know, we have state groups where we actually sit down and help each other with our research, try and give them ideas about resources, to where to find information. And we just pass information out. It's also a chance to network. And sometimes, you know, we have what we call brick walls, and so a lot of times we are able to help our members, I guess, overcome those brick walls. And
wow,
so it gives
awesome.
Us just a forum to discuss your research and your problem areas that you're having.
And last question: did President Obama's election make a difference? Did you see a spike in your membership?
No, not really. You know, I guess it made us all proud, I guess, because, we just never thought we'd see the day when an African American became president of the United States, and so it was just a wonderful thing to occur, you know, during our lifetime.
Okay, I think we're going to end. I'm going to try to play a clip from Alex Haley's album where he talks about researching. And
okay.
And I want to thank you for coming on, and you look great. And hopefully I'll be able to meet you at one of your meetings.
Well, please do. And thank you very much for inviting me to participate.
Okay, we'll have you on again.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
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 When we got to that village, near it, the little children playing on the perimeter of the village gave the alert. And the people came hustling out of the village. It's a very small village, only about 70 people. And as they rushed toward me, I had entered into something that is described as the peak experience. It is that which emotionally one experiences that nothing ever in the rest of your life can transcend. And I feel certain that is what was my experience that morning in that village. When the people came, I saw among them a short man, compactly built, an off-white robe, a pillbox hat. And when they got closer, the interpreters with me, sure enough, went to him. And meanwhile, the 70-odd people of this little village came rushing toward me. They came quickly, curiously around me. They were around me in sort of in a horseshoe design. Had I held out my arms at full length, I would have touched the nearest ones on either side. And they were about 3-4 deep all around. And the first thing that got to me was the intensity of how they were staring at me. The eyes just raked from head to foot. The foreheads were furrowed in the intensity of their staring. And I felt very, very discomforted being stared at as if I was a thing or something. And the first thing that got to me was I began to have now another feeling. It was also in me, and yet it seemed apart. It was visceral, as if my insides were going to churn around or something. I felt almost nauseous. And I remember standing up there thinking to myself, what in the world is the matter with you? And what came to me was that I had been in crowds lots of times in my life, but for the first time in my life, I was in a crowd and I was the only one of my complexion which might be said to be brown. Everybody else I was looking at was jet black. And emotionally, that thing hit me like a thunderbolt. I, to this day, don't know the components of why I felt as I did. And you know, it's sort of like body English. If we are insecure, uncertain, whatnot, we tend to drop our glances, and I dropped mine, and without having intended to do so, I found myself looking, almost studying my own hands, the color of my hands, inside, outside, and naturally, involuntarily, it's in contrast with their complexions. And this time, it didn't take so much time. I had this rolling wave of feeling come over me. It was just terrible, awful. I felt hybrid. I felt impure among the pure, and it was just awful. I remember standing there being rocked by that when the old man left the interpreters and briskly walked away, at which point all the people around me quickly left me and went to the old man. One of the interpreters, his name was Salah, came up and spoke quickly, whispering sort of in my ear. And what he said rocked me as much as the rest when I understood the import of it. He said, why they stare at you so, they have never in this place seen a black American. And I suddenly realized they were not looking at me as Alex Haley, writer, individual, as I tend to think of myself, but they were seeing me through their eyes as the symbol of the 25 plus millions of us black people in this country whom they had never seen. And it was just awesome to realize that someone had imputed to you that enormity of symbolism. Well, I was standing there kind of rocked by that when just sort of adjacent were now all these people, 70-odd of them, clustered around this old man. And they were darting glances at me, and there was intense conversation in Mandinka. And although I couldn't understand a syllable of it, yet in some way there's a universal language of gestures, nuances, inflection. And somehow I knew exactly what they were talking about. I knew they were trying to arrive at how did they feel collectively about me symbolizing to them all we black people in this country whom they never had seen. And there came a point when the old man turned, and quickly as was his way, he walked right through the people. He walked right up to me, stood maybe a yard from me, his eyes piercing into mine, and he spoke in Mandinka as if he felt I instinctively ought to understand it, which of course I couldn't, and the translation came from the side. And once I understood the import of that translation or the words, I made a vow to myself that once I get this book and the film and everything all settled, down pretty well. I am going to see these words put in some appropriate permanent location somewhere along the southern coast of this United States and along the western coast of Africa. The way that they decided they felt about me symbolizing to them all we black people in this country whom they never had seen. And the translation was, quote, "Yes, we have been told by the forefathers that there are many of us from this place who are in exile in that place called America and in other places." And that was the way they felt about it. The old man, the griot, his name was Keba Kanga Fofana. He had 73 reigns, their way of saying 73 years of age. One reign is season a year. He began now to tell me the history of the Kente clan. I should tell you that one of the most awesome things I have since come to try and deal with was that if, and this particular if ought to be in letters 6 feet high because it is so rarely possible because of intervening occurrences, nonetheless, if any black person in this auditorium, any black person in this country only could know a few vital clues, if he or she only could know what was the original African name of the forefather, the foreparents brought out of Africa, if he or she only could know when were they brought out and from where were they brought out, that to this day it is not impossible that the contemporary black American might be put in touch with a wizened old griot somewhere in backcountry black West Africa who could tell the contemporary black American literally the ancestral clan from whence he or she sprang, if they could know those clues. I was there, blessed to know the things I had gotten through a series of miracles, which had begun on a West Tennessee front porch from my grandmother and other elder relatives. And now I was about to hear the story of the Kente clan, because I had been able to say, as had been the case, that my forefather in this country always had insisted his name was Kente. I should tell you that when a griot begins to speak, it's a neo-religious occasion within a village. The people get in a wide semicircle. Their posture is something kind of like parade rest. The griot sits. He comes forward. As he begins to speak, he bends forward. His torso is rigid. The cords stand out in his neck. He speaks, and the words are almost as if a scroll is being read. He would say two or three sentences, and the interpretation or translation would come to me. When I had heard a good fair amount of it, I was absolutely awed, immersed in just wonder that such could be, that out of this man's memory and his mouth was coming such an incredible array of lineage. All the way across a family line 100-odd years ago, who married whom? What children in what order? All the way across that line, then drop back down to the children themselves, each child whom they had married, their children in what order, all the way across. I was struck by the biblical way it was being expressed in the translations. And so took as a wife so-and-so, and begot. And every now and then when he would name some begot or other, he would tell some little thing about that person, which had happened later in life. I can strip out of the hours I was to hear that day into a few minutes the history that I was to hear of the Kente clan, and I again remind that the counterpart of his history exists this day is somewhere in backcountry black West Africa for every single black American there is, if he or she only could know the clues and only could be put in touch with the right griot. He said that the Kente clan had been begun in the country called Old Mali. The men preponderantly were blacksmiths. The women were mostly potters and weavers. A branch of that clan had moved into the country called Mauritania, and it was out of Mauritania that one son of that clan, his name Katariba Kunta Kinte, had come. He was a young marabou, which is to say a holy man of the Muslim faith. The people of that section, as I've said, historically were predominantly Muslim of faith. Kariba Kunta Kinte, as a young marabou, moved down into the long, narrow country called the Gambia. He stopped first in a village called Pakalinding, and then he went to a village called Jifarong, and he went next to a village called Jufare. The village of Jufare took his first wife, a Mandinka maiden whose name was Cyrene, and by Cyrene he begot two sons whose names were Jane and Saloon. Then, Muslim man, plural marriages, he took a second wife, her name Yesa, and by Yesa he begot a son whose name was Omaro. The three sons grew up there in the village of Jufare, and when they came of age, the elder two, Jane and Saloon, went away and founded a new village called Kinte Kunda Jane Ya. And then the youngest of them, Omaro, stayed there until he had 30 years of age. Then he took a wife. Her name was Binta Keba. And by Binta Keba, within the decade that we in our calendar system would call roughly between 1750 and 1760, Omaro Kinte begot four sons, who in the orders of their arrival were named Kunta, Lamine, Suwadu, and Madi. The old man had been talking for about in excess of 2 hours when he got down to that level of the family. Then, as he had stopped, I would suppose, 50 times, it would seem, in the course of that time, to tell some little tangential thing about some individual, some begot or other, he stopped now and he spoke, and the translation came from the side. And I heard in disbelief. It began about the time the king's soldiers came. And I interject to tell you that's one of those time-fixing references which griot storytellers use to fix events. They use events to fix dates. And if you would know the event, you must find the date. But anyway, here in backcountry Black West Africa, hearing the ancestral story of the Kinte clan told because I had been able to come saying my forefather had always insisted that was his name, now I heard this wizened old griot say through the interpreter, quote, about the time the king's soldiers came, the eldest of these four sons, Kunta, went away from this village to chop wood, and he was never seen again. And he went on with his story. Well, I sat there as if I was carved of rock. Goose pimples that felt to be the size of grapes all over me. There was no way in the world for that man to know what he had said to me. It was with physical effort that I got my hand into my duffel bag and got out my little notebooks. The first book, the early part of it, was devoted to a kind of a synthesis of what Grandma and Aunt Liz and Cousin Georgia and Aunt Vine and all of them had said. And I showed it to the interpreter, Salah, and I watched as he read, and he began to perceive the meaning of it. And he got very agitated. He went to the old man, talking very rapidly, explaining to him. The old man, after a point, all but grabbed the book, jabbing his finger at his pages, talking very rapidly to the people, explaining the significance that I had come from a place where my forebear on this side had been one who always said his name was Kinte, who had always said he was not far from his village chopping wood with the intent to make a drum when he had been surprised, set upon, captured into slavery. I remember I had been sitting on a little three-legged stool with a cowhide top, and I just felt like helium had been pumped into me. I popped up like a jack-in-the-box, just stood up. I don't remember anyone giving an order. I just remember subsequently becoming aware that those people, the 70-odd of them, had formed a circle, a ring around me. They were sort of dancing, it might be said, a kind of hitching progress dance, counterclockwise. The movements kind of like drum major. It's the high knee action. They were chanting something, their voices alternately loud and soft. And I'm standing there in the middle of them, feeling like an atom in the desert. How could you feel? I felt wiped out. And I remember I happened to be looking right toward the face of one of the about 12 ladies in that moving circle who had little infants over their back the way they carry them in those claws, as this lady with a fierce scowl on this shinola black face broke from the circle, charging in toward me, her bare feet knocking up little puffs of dust. And when she got to me, she took her infant and all but thrust it at me. The gesture saying, take it, and I took it, and I clasped it the way we instinctively do babies. And as soon as I had it clasped pretty good, she all but snatched it away from me, and there stood another lady with her baby. And it went on. I suppose it took about 2 minutes for me to hug all those babies. I would be back in this country, speaking at Harvard University, and a very famous scholar in this country, Dr. Jerome Bruner, who knows of such things, said later to me, you were participating in, and you did not know it, one of the oldest ceremonies of humankind called the laying on of hands. That in their way they were saying to you, through this flesh, which is us, we are you and you are us. And there were many, many other things that were going to happen that day in that village, almost too emotional to try and deal with. One I remember was the men took me to their mosque. I didn't know what to do. I'm Methodist, they are Muslim, and I was trying to be careful to do the right thing, watching out of the corner of my eye. You take off your shoes to go in there, you're down on your knees, and I remember down there on my knees feeling so forlorn and lost and thinking, I found out where I've come from, I don't even understand what they're saying. They were praying around me in this high nasal wailing Arabic. And later when we came out, the crux of what they were praying was translated for me. It was, praise be to Allah for one lost long from us whom God has returned. And things just went on till it got to the fact that emotionally I could not handle anymore. I told them I wanted, if I could, to go out by land. We had come by water up the river, and it turned out it was long enough after the rainy season. It could be arranged. And I was going out now. It was set up. I would go out with a driver in a Land Rover. Backcountry, Black West Africa. The monkeys, the incredible foliage, the green parrots that streak around screaming at you. Just backcountry sight sounds that I'd never had any idea about, because just cannot describe Africa unless you've been there. And as we were going along, there was also in my mind a great turmoil. It began to come in my head as we might have a dream. As when we sleep, a rough, ragged newsreel type of thing. It was as if all that I had read by now about the ways that Africans had been brought out of Africa seemed to be enacted. I began to see the way that along in the coastal areas, as had been the case with Kunta, mostly they were people who were kidnapped because they were close to the coast. But further back inland, I began to see the way that by far most of the slaves were captured, come screaming awake at night with the thatched roofs of their homes falling in on them, a fire, a flame, the thatch was in flames, and they would rush out into the bedlam, into the carnage, and those who survived it in any kind of fit shape were captured as prisoners, linked neck to neck with thongs into what were called coffles. If you do much reading in this, you will run into that word coffles, C-O-F-F-L-E-S. It is said that some coffles of slaves were as much as a mile in length, and they would begin those tortuous marches from wherever the villages were down toward the areas where the ships were. And when they got down, with many dying along the way for many reasons, and when they got to the shoreline area, the survivors were herded into long, low buildings built of small timbers and thatched roofs called barracoons. In the barracoons, they would be washed, they would be fed, almost force-fed, they would be crudely medicated to hurry them toward a fit physical condition. When it was considered that they were in sufficient condition, now a few at a time, they would be moved out into the yards of the barracoons, and there the owners of the ships would come, the captains and the mates, and there would ensue these hideous physical examinations, every orifice of the human body, and then the purchases, and then the branding, usually between the shoulder blade, usually with the initial of the ship that was going to take them out. And then would come the time, as I pictured it in my mind's eye from things I'd read, that they were being moved from the barracoon across that strip of beach to the little cockle shell canoes. at the edge of the water. And when these Africans from the inland areas, many of whom had never seen the sea, they were terrified. Those who saw the surf march up the beach, to them it was the jaws of some incomprehensible animal. They'd never seen anything like that. A ship lying offshore was to them a floating, flying house or something like that. They didn't even know what a ship was. It seemed it was when those Africans were being moved from Barracoon toward the canoes that for the first time they began to perceive the enormity of the unknown that was in store for them. Because it was on that beach that I had read so many times that so many of them who up to this time had been virtually stoic went into absolute spasms of terror. They would fall prone on the beach. They were groveling. They were screaming. They would use their fingers like claws digging into the sand. They would use their necks and heads like the beaks of giant birds trying to bite up one last hold on the land that was their own. And they were beaten up from that, beaten down across the further beach onto and into those canoes that took them out through the surf, out to the ships. And it was into the holds of those ships that they were put. And that was how the ancestors of every black person in this country without exception were brought here. There were no exceptions. There was no other way. And I was riding along with my head so full of this when we came to a big village up ahead. And I looked up ahead and I was astounded to realize that those people up there knew what had happened behind us in village of Jufere. Obviously they knew. Obviously someone had come out and the news had relayed ahead of it before I had left. Because ahead of us now, there were poles staked along the road. There were green liana vines hanging like the cords from microphones, but thicker. And at intervals along these vines hung the great glossy green saboa leaves that Africans or Gambians use for sunshades or umbrellas. And the people were thronging out into the road, milling, waving. We could see them as we approached. And they were crying out some cacophony of sound. And we came on the driver slowing down. When he finally got to the people, I guess he was doing then maybe 2 miles an hour. And we were trying to nudge, he was, through the people who were all jostling and crowding around. I didn't know what to do. Again, I felt this full of helium feeling. I just stood up again like a jack-in-the-box, now in the Land Rover. And I'm looking down at these people who are jet black all around, wizened elders and all ages and sizes and whatnot. And it came to me, looking at them staring up at me as they waved, what a huge caprice it was. There they were looking at me, seeing me as a symbol of all we 25-plus million black people over here. And I, in turn, am using, in effect, our eyes, looking at them, seeing people who have never left Africa since the beginning of man, so far as we know. And the huge caprice was that the only reason either of us was in either place was that caprice of which of our forefathers had happened to be taken out of Africa and which had been left there. That was the only reason either of us was in either locale. And I was full of that going on in among those people when I suppose we had gotten about a third of the way through them, and I suddenly began to understand what it was that they all were crying out. I think I hadn't understood it because I didn't understand their tongue, and they were all closely clustered, and I didn't get anything but the wall of sound as opposed to the individual sounds. But it began to come to me now that what they were all crying out, from wizened old elders, the men, the old grandmothers with skin like leather, their breasts like old bell straps, the childbearing women, many of them pregnant, the maidens, the youth, and the little youngsters, jaybird naked of both sexes, they were all milling, thronging, looking up at me with beaming, bullion expressions on their faces. And what they were crying out, which I had not understood now, until now, was, Mr. Kinte, Mr. Kinte. And I tell you what, I am a man, but I remember when a sob hit me about ankle level, I remember throwing my hands up to my face, my fingers, and shrieking, crying. I don't think I ever cried like that since I was a little baby. It just seemed to me that if one really knew the story of black people, if one knew the way that our forefathers had been brought here, that it really didn't matter what one thought about black people individually or collectively, but it just seemed that as a human being, one ought to weep that that thing called slavery had ever happened in the annals of human being. And I just couldn't help it. I wept on out through that village and all the way, more or less, until we got back to Dakar. And I got myself onto a flight back to New York. And when I got there, I found that it took me a while to get used to being back. About half a day that I couldn't even call my own people. And then I called my brother, George. And he told me the sad news that while I was away, Cousin Georgia had died in Kansas City. My brother's a lawyer. He's very orderly. And he brought me a folder with the data about the funeral. Then it included a hospital report. And on there was time of death. And I went the way I sort of fiddle around with information, and I made the time transfer from Kansas City to West Africa. And then it hit me like a thunderbolt when suddenly I realized what had in fact happened, that as the last survivor among them all, Cousin Georgia, the youngest who had told the story to me, and to whom I had gone back several times since our reunion, because she was my source of strength, my source of support, my source of story, my source of history. And now it seemed that as the last survivor, one of the reasons that I have to feel that this whole thing was meant to be was that the time transfer or the transposition of the time zones from Kansas City to West Africa showed that Cousin Georgia had died literally within the hour that I had stepped foot in that village in Africa. And it always since has seemed to me that as that last survivor, it was her role to see me to that village where the link across the ocean in the family story would be made. And then Cousin Georgia, too, went on and joined the rest to watch me and see what would I do with it. It was a charging moment and a kind of motivation that it is hard to put to words. I got myself together emotional enough to go to the publishers, and I told them the story of what had happened. I told them that actually I wanted to write a book that technically would be the story of a family, my own, but which broadly would really be the saga of a people, that every black person, it does not matter who he or she is, ancestrally traces back to some African, born and reared in some village, captured in some way, put into some ship, brought across the same ocean into some succession of plantations. And I told them that what I wanted to do now was write a book that would be the symbol story, the saga of all black people, and it would be a book called Roots. I told them that I had to have, what we call in the writing business, saturation research, and they said they understood. It meant that I would try to bring every possible thing to this book, every avenue of research, everything I could commit myself to. And what intrigued me now, and it was because of my Coast Guard background, was the ship that had brought Kunta over. I had some clues. When I was a little boy, Grandma and the others always had said that ship brought him to Annapolis, they would pronounce it. There was no place they could possibly have been talking about but Annapolis, Maryland. It was at that time I did a little quick reading, a burgeoning young city vying for supremacy as a port with Baltimore. Numerous ships came in and out of Annapolis, some of them slave ships on occasion. I had another clue, and that was that now I knew where the African Kunta Kinte had come from, the Gambia River. And the next thing I needed to know was, about when had this ship sailed? And I had a clue for that too, as the old griot had said, prefacing his story of Kunta.